Hello, politicos, and welcome to another episode of the Queen's Park Briefing Podcast. It is a disgustingly rainy, snowy, sleety Friday afternoon here on the fourth floor of Queen's Park. My name is Aiden Chimandi. I'm a reporter with Queen's Park Briefing. Today, I'm joined by
Laura Walton, and I'm the president of CUPE's Ontario School Board Council of Unions.
And that is a name and a voice that all of you should be familiar with, because we know you're all dedicated listeners of the CUPE Briefing Podcast. You watch all the media studio interviews. You're familiar with Laura's Rosie the Riveter costume that she did one press conference in. So Laura, thank you for joining us, and thank you for joining us on an ugly Friday. Listeners in the kind of pre-show. Sorry, I interrupted you. I've been talking a lot.
Oh, no, I just going to say I'm happy to be here. It's a nice way to actually spend a Friday afternoon. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, for me, it beats writing a story. So in the little pre-show banter we were having, I was saying, hey, I don't know a ton about you. Your LinkedIn doesn't have a ton of information. So wondering if we could start with some softballs, just kind of who Laura Walton is, how she got started in education, union politics, left politics generally. So yeah. I believe you come from an education family. Is that correct?
I do come from an education family. I actually come from a public service sector family. My dad is a retired principal. My mom is a retired nurse who is currently back doing some work within the healthcare sector, given the current crisis we have there. My stepmom is a teacher. My grandma was a school secretary. So come from a real public service sector took a long route to get to education. I didn't start working as an EA until about 20 years ago. Prior to that, I spent some time in the media industry, where I worked for Standard Broadcasting back in the day, which is totally dating myself, I'm sure. Found that wasn't going to be conducive to being a family person, being a mom. So went back to my original love and original plan, which was to work in schools.
Did you want to, like, was education work kind of a dream when you were a kid? How did the media stuff come around?
So education work was something that I originally wanted to do. It was either journalism or education was the two things. And it's funny, a friend of mine reminded me that, that was my plan in the yearbook when I graduated from high school. But when I graduated from high school, it was the early 90s. Education jobs were few and far between. There was a glut of workers and not enough jobs. And there was next to impossible to get into teachers' college. So I took a different route and decided, hey, the journalism is really what I think I want to do. And then ended up actually working more in the media sales and copywriting and making, that kind of work. And then, decided to come back to it in the end, and really glad that I have.
And as far as union organizing, union involvement, was that something your family did talk about around the dinner table and all that? Like, how'd you come into the union space?
Super interesting question. And it's funny, through this process, I found out just how deep those roots go. I knew about, my dad's involvement during the Mike Harris years, where he was pulled out from ETFO due to Mike Harris removing principals. I know that he walked on the line with his teaching staff in solidarity. I also knew that my mom, when she worked with ONA, had done some organizing around nurses and home visit nurses. And then come to find out through this, my grandmother, who is in her mid-90s, shared that her grandmother Effie was actually involved in grassroots organizing a significant time ago, where she went around in a horse and carriage doing a petition to allow women to attend school beyond grade 8. So, it was interesting to find out that the roots of, activism run a lot deeper than what I thought.
Had you been involved politically at all as a kid? Because, the organizing world, the skills are transferable.
Yeah. So when I was a little girl, my dad was actually a counselor in Tyndinaga Township. And so I remember as a little girl going up to the Royal York with the, Association of Municipalities of Ontario and kind of listening in on the, the bustle that was. I've always been really attracted to politics, I did political science in university, love that kind of idea of, what makes things tick. But the organizing, you know, that really started to come later on. And, you know, I did a little bit of student activism when I was in university, have been always, you know, aware of issues, have always been very left-leaning, you know, but and come from a conservative area. So that might be partly why. But, you know, just I've always learned, and I, you know, I look back on it now and I wish that I knew that labor history was something you could take in university, you know, many, many moons ago, because I probably would have loved to do that. It's something that I stumbled onto later in my life, and really enjoyed learning about how things came to be.
Shout out Brock University and the labor studies program there. I turned to their professors a lot for analysis of labor history and labor relations. And
Larry Savage is a dynamo there.
Yes. Yeah.
Stephanie Ross.
Spoke to him a lot. Spoke to Larry a lot. I want to talk about the politics a little bit. So you say you're very left-leaning, come from a conservative area, but you come from a family that is involved in unions and public sector education, you know, typical left-leaning thing. So wondering if you have an idea of kind of where the roots of your politics come from. Is it primarily informed by, you know, labor movement, labor history? Can you speak a little bit about that?
I think where a lot of my politics came from was growing up in a public sector household. You know, being the daughter of a nurse, being the daughter of a teacher, who then moved to being a principal, we always knew that, you know, our parents were helping out the community. And my parents were also really big on, you know, ensuring that you were involved in your community. I worked for the township as a teenager. I worked for the city of Belleville as a teenager. You know, so very active in what you can do for your community and how you can interact. And I hope I've instilled those same sort of, you know, volunteerism pieces with my own children. But I think, you know, where my left-leaning politics came from is just this idea that as a community, and maybe it's because I grew up in a rural area, you need to band together in order to achieve. Nobody can do this just on their own. And individualism is not going to be able to carry us all the way through. And I think, you know, growing up in that rural community surrounded by family and friends where, you know, you did rely a lot on, you know, others in your community to help you out. I think that really became the basis. And then as I grew and as I learned and, you know, I was really fortunate in high school to have really forward thinking, progressive teachers that really challenged us to think outside of the box and to really consider how things happen. I think that was, you know, really, really key. And then, you know, having the opportunity and the privilege to be able to go out and have experiences at university, you know, I think it just all became one big picture.
So I could ask you about your background forever, but I'm sure listeners want to know, you know, about the strike and about the fallout and all that stuff. So I will go on to that now. And you serve notice of bargaining the day after the election, before all the other unions. Why did you make that choice?
Well, actually, we tried. We were really wanting. There is a stipulation in the School Board Collective Bargaining Act that the minister can actually allow us to bargain before that. And that's what happened in 2019. So we actually had asked at the time, would the minister consider allowing us to bargain early? And that was turned down solidly. But we wanted to be out right away, and for a number of factors. Education workers, the world is different. We work through the summer. If we aren't working through the summer, we're in a period of layoff. We do not have the same sort of service security, job security that other workers in the education system do. And our collective agreement actually states at the time, you know, we would be losing our job security. And so that was a real big issue for us. You know, this idea that we knew that school boards could just, and they did. So it wasn't like we were guessing. The school boards actually did cut jobs unnecessarily because they were able to. So that was one of the reasons why we went out early. But another reason why we went out early the last time, not as early, but you know, we did go out earlier. One of the learnings that we had from the 2019 round was that people have no idea who education workers are. And that was really solidified during the pandemic, where anything that had to do with education, you know, people were talking about teachers and the impact on teachers. And yet there were tens of thousands of workers that were on site in school throughout the pandemic and were completely ignored. And it was a real big fight during the pandemic to even get the ministry to recognize them and make sure that they were taken care of. And so we wanted to make sure that we were out and we were talking about the issues that directly impacted education workers. That's not to say that the issues that, you know, our teaching colleagues are facing are not important. They are absolutely important, but there are some significant differences that are happening with education workers.
So I do want to follow up on that, but really quickly, to your point about, you know, people don't really know a lot about education workers, I'm wondering if you could very quickly explain how the summer works for you guys, because I think some people might be surprised to learn, oh, they're unemployed or they're worked. Like, how does this work?
So if you are what's considered a 10-month person, it means that you work from September until June. And once June comes along, 60% of our members receive a layoff notice. They are laid off. They have no job whatsoever. And there's the understanding that the board will hire you back in September. And that's handled within contract language. And, you know, it's dealt with that way. But you receive no money, none. You go on EI, or you try and get a job. And, you know, that has proven really difficult. I can tell you, as somebody who worked as an EA for 20 years, there isn't a whole lot of people out there that want to hire somebody just for the summer, knowing that they're going to go back to another job in September. And a lot of times I found that we were competing against my own kids for positions, which is really, really problematic because, you know, there are jobs that are intended for students to get earnings so that they can go off and proceed through post-secondary. So it is a little bit of a challenge. There is about 35% of our membership that works through the summer, meaning that they are on site, they are working, you know, our custodial caretaking, maintenance, some of our clerical, our IT, they are doing work when the students are not there to get the school back into shape for when they do show up in September. So it is a really unique situation. We don't have a 12-month salary. We don't have, you know, I've been told a lot of things, 10 months of vacation or 10 weeks of vacation. We don't have any of that good stuff.
So getting back to the thing that I said I would originally follow up on, you know, the kind of people don't know education workers, everyone thinks teachers and whatnot. And in an interview, I believe you gave to Chris Rushaway of the Toronto Star recently, I was just reading that article, and there was one quote here that I wanted to follow up on and just get you to elaborate on, because I think it speaks to what you're talking about a little bit. We knew that because we were focusing on wage, it wasn't the same for us as it was for teachers. So can you explain a little bit there and kind of the bargaining philosophy around why you kind of went in alone? Because I know there was talks of doing it all together.
Yeah, there was. First of all, I think that we have gotten to this place in the world where we don't value labor and what the value of labor is. Everybody's labor, all workers' labor. And there's been like this, we won't talk about our wages kind of mentality that's been happening for quite some time. And one of the things that we knew, because we did a wage survey, is we knew the impact of our wages and how it was impacting workers. And we knew that they made on average $39,000 a year. I mean, people tried as much as they could, including the minister, to, you know, tear that apart and say it wasn't true. And because we were all part-time and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, we had the data that backed it up. And we recognized that, you know, for a lot of people, when you say education workers, they automatically go to the sunshine list. There are all these people on the sunshine list. How dare you ask for more money? And we wanted to be very clear that that is not the reality. There are tens of thousands of workers that are in your school system that are struggling to make ends meet. And that became really important for us to get those voices out there and to make sure that people understood the reality of what's happening in, you know, the education sector.
And so the negotiations get started. They obviously take a turn for the worse. I'm on the fourth floor of Queen's Park where I was watching the protest. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how, I know you have before, but talk a little bit about how that kind of mass solidarity protest came about, any kind of reservations you had, because this is obviously something we've not seen in Ontario for a very long time. So I can understand if you might have been a little skittish that something like this might not be able to be pulled off.
You know, it's interesting because we had started working way back in January and having conversations with workers and saying, like, what is this going to take? And, you know, if it takes a strike, and what if they say, and we would say to people, gee, like, what if they tell you you can't go on strike? What are you going to do? And we were already working through what that would look like. So when the time came, and I was actually a little bit shocked when they brought me in on Sunday night and showed me this, you know, legislation and said, you know, if you don't If you don't accept this agreement and call off your strike, we're just going to legislate this. And at the time, I remember thinking, I don't believe you're going to underestimate folks again. We had just delivered one of the highest, you know, vote percent participation in the history of labor. And, you know, I kind of thought to myself, like, what did you think they meant when they voted? Like, did you think they were joking? And at the time, I remember thinking, okay, this is going to be real. So we had behind the scenes, we had numerous, very emotional conversations with a lot of people saying, this is what this is going to look like. And what came really clear for me is that, and one of my bargaining team members said it, in the last 10 years, you know, education workers have been working under legislated agreements, and we never did anything about it. We just said, oh, okay, that's the legislation. And then we go to court. And we knew that the courts weren't going to save us. They didn't save us in Bill 115. Members received a remedy, but the remedy was not sufficient to, you know, make them whole. Bill 124, we see the chaos going on right now. I mean, the premier could just say, okay, you know, the ruling's here, that's fine. But instead, he's choosing to fight it. And we said, no, we're not going to take this anymore. And so we put it back to folks and said, this is where we're going to go. And there is a ton of hesitation because you're asking people to do things that are not proper. It's civil disobedience, right? It's saying, yep, there's a law that says you can't strike, but you're going to go anyways. And I think when it became clear that we had the capacity to do this, it kind of gave some wind in a lot of labor's sails to say, oh, this is real. We can do this. And I think that's, you know, just a shout out to my like family, my labor family, you know, who just took it and ran with it and made sure it was happening.
So this next question you've been asked a lot and everyone's kind of been talking about it since the election. It's, you know, the PC's private sector union push and all that stuff, you know, changing meaning of labor in this economy. But I figure, you know, even though you have been asked the question a lot, we're however many weeks and months out from, you know, the kind of height of the strikes, you have a contract. I don't know, we're going into Christmas. Maybe it's a bit more of a reflective time. So I'm interested just in your thoughts around the evolving role of labor unions in, you know, a conservative Ontario where we're coming out of a pandemic and, you know, the economy is changing before our eyes and who knows where it's going to be in 5 years. So, like, what is your role in unions and labor's role generally? How is it evolving?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I would like to say is the role of laborers needs to be handed back to the workers. You know, there's this like this kind of narrative out there that there are these big union bosses that make decisions for workers and that the workers just comply. And, you know, I frequently will say to people, I'm not your boss. You will direct me on what you need to do. You will tell me what you need. And I think that, you know, I really encourage labor in general to put the workers first, put the workers in the center of this. And that's how we're going to get through kind of this, you know, conservative, you know, world that we're living in right now. You know, I think the fact that Monty McNaughton recognizes that he needs to be the party that's working for workers in and of itself, he understands the value of unions. He may not want to understand the value of unions in a public sector context, but he honestly can see the value of unions in a private sector context. And they're really not that different. And I think, you know, what it is worker voice. And if we can begin as labor to acknowledge worker voice and have that worker voice out there and be listening to it, I think it's going to be a better world in general. This isn't about, you know, one or two people sitting around a table making decisions. Everything that we did and everything that we do comes back to what the workers need and what the workers want and ensuring that they have a voice. And workers are not always going to agree. And that's okay. That's how we actually build a stronger society. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to be romantic and think that we want, you know, the old Winnipeg general strike, but there's a time, you know, my daughter lives in the UK. She's going to school there. And, you know, I see what the UK is doing, you know, with their Enough is Enough campaign. There is a point where we just need to say enough is enough and join together and really push back. The individualism, you know, the profiteering, it's got to stop. And one of the best ways to do that is for people to come together. And unions is one of the ways that we can do that.
I'm sorry if any listeners wanted me to follow up specifically on that question, but in the same way that Laura wants, you know, union politics to be returned back to the workers, this is a provincial politics podcast, so I got to return to the politics. Yeah. So I think everyone knows kind of where you stand in your relationship with the government and the official opposition, but I'm very interested in your relationship with and kind of attitudes towards the Liberals, because you mentioned Bill 115. That obviously, I don't even know how many years ago that was, but a while ago. 10 years ago. Yeah. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, public sector workers never really a fan of the Tories, but you kind of had a bit of a more on again, off again relationship with the Liberals. I spoke to some Liberals, staffers, MPPs, people around the party when the strikes were going on, who were kind of keen to speak at the rally or be present with union leaders and membership. But that didn't ultimately materialize because of the hangover of Bill 115. So given that the Liberals were kind of seemed to be on your side in this one, you know, what do you make of the reaction the strike effort got from the party? What do you make of the party's views towards and relationship with labor generally, with 115 and now 124 and the strikes hanging over all of it?
Well, you know, I watched with interest when John Fraser actually apologized for Bill 115 in the House that day. And I thought that was, you know, a long time coming. And I commend him for, you know, making that statement. I think, you know, one of the things that I always find very challenging about politics is that people seem to focus just on election day. Well, this is the party in power, and then we all kind of go away. And I believe that, you know, it's incumbent on all of us to work with all groups, but hold everybody accountable. People are going to make mistakes. There's going to be policy that doesn't make everybody happy. I have learned myself, I can't make everybody happy all of the time. And you know, there's going to be things that make other people unhappy, but it's key to be working with everybody. And I actually would, you know, be more than happy to have conversations with Stephen Lecce and Doug Ford. We never seem to be offered that opportunity. But you know, I had some really great conversations with Mitzi Hunter as we were going through this, had some great conversations with Mike Schreiner going through this. You know, I think this was a pivotal time where people recognize that, you know, when you are a politician of any sort of stripe, you have a lot of privilege and a lot of responsibility. And, you know, it's really important that we all are communicating together. You know, I truly believe that we should be always asking every single candidate, you know, here are the issues that affect me. What is your take on this? And I think we've moved so far away from that we've seen, you know, a party win twice without a platform, because people aren't asking about issues. They're just basing it on promises. And I think, you know, it's really about how are you going to address it? Anyone can talk about what the problems are, but it's what you're going to do about it. And I think that's what I'm looking forward to, you know, in the future. We have 3 years. Before, you know, the next election is even going to be contemplated, hopefully. And, you know, I think, yeah, exactly. Stranger things have happened, you know, but we have 3 years that I think we need to be working on. What are the issues facing people in Ontario today? And what are we going to do about it? And how are they going to handle it? And how, as, you know, people who live in Ontario, we're not exempt from the process. We have a duty to be involved and to be pushing our elected leaders to ensure that they are, you know, responding to what we need.
Okay, I got to follow up because I didn't get the direct answer that I was looking for. do you think, like, how do you think Bill 115 still affects Labor's relationship with the Liberal Party? Is it still a thorn in the side?
Absolutely, because when Bill 28 was passed, I said it was Bill 115. They learned from Bill 115. They purposely put in a notwithstanding clause because Bill 115 was already on the books as, you know, being passed, having gone to the courts, having a remedy paid out. Bill 115, I don't think people, and it's only really education workers that remember it, right? Because it didn't apply to anybody else. But, you know, Bill 115 is something that I will never forget. As a matter of fact, that was our campaign for a few years following it, that QP members don't forget, and we will not forget. But, you know, Mitzi Hunter and I spoke about it, and I said, it was a really silly move that you did. And she said, yes. And I said, and unfortunately, you guys forgot to tell them about that as they moved to Bill 28. And I have huge respect for Mitzi, huge respect for John for making those kinds of statements and recognizing it was a blight on, you know, labor relations. I don't think that legislation should ever be used in the context of labor relations.
sticking with the politics, something that has been bandied about a lot in this office, the QP briefing office, is, has Laura Walton been approached to run for a political party? Does Laura Walton want to run for a political party? Does Laura Walton rule it out entirely?
So here's what Laura Walton would say to that. I have not been approached, but, you know, it's also not an election campaign time. I believe that I have more things to do here right now. And I really want to focus. If you look at, for instance, the LA teachers, it was a 10-year plan to get where they are. And I'm only about 3 years into my 10-year plan. But the workers will, you know, really direct me in that. It's not something that I put out of my mind. It's not something that's in my mind. And I made a joke the other day to somebody and said, maybe when I'm a bit older, wiser, and my skin is a bit thicker, I'll be ready to do that. But, you know, I think what's really important to me is that regardless of where I am, I need to stay in touch with the people who put me there. And so, you know, that is super important to me, regardless of the role that I'm playing, is making sure that the people who put their faith in me, that I'm, you know, in touch with them. So, you know, I know there has been people who have, you know, chatted about it. You know, would I go back to Bay Aquini, where I live, to take a run at Todd Smith? He's safe for now. You know, I'm not going to say what the future is going to hold. I'm hoping that, you know, I can finish out my 10-year plan here, and then we'll see where the wind takes me. Provincial politics is much more exciting to me than federal politics. Unfortunately, it's just something that makes my heart sing a little bit more. But there's also municipal politics. So, and I've always promised that, you know, when I retire, I will become a school board trustee. That will be definitely when I retire. That is in my game plan for sure.
Okay. Well, as someone who covered federal politics for a few years before coming to the provincial scene, I can totally agree. Provincial politics, way more important. Very interesting, just not sold properly.
Yeah, no, not sold properly. Yeah. If folks really understood the value of provincial politics and the actual weight that provincial politics holds, geez, it would be exciting.
So in journalism school, we're always told to ask like the kind of the maybe meaner or tougher questions at the end. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. So, you know, you, you're the president of the OSBCU. Every time I see the Twitter handle, I think of the Italian dish, Ossobuco.
Yeah,
there we go. I wanted to joke about that with you off air, but now listeners will get it.
You know what? I often think about it when I see it too, and I work here, so don't feel bad. We may have to do a party.
So, okay. So, you know, you are a labor leader. You said earlier about how, you know, everything flows from the workers, and I get that, but I can't help but think, okay, in politics, if the chief government whip or if the premier said, hey, caucus, this is how I think you should vote, and caucus didn't vote that way, there would be punishment. Mm-hmm. There would be some kind of repercussions for the leader. Given that you said you don't think folks should vote for this deal, but then you ultimately did vote for the deal and it did go through. Do you think you're still fit to lead the OSBCU?
Absolutely. I think if anything, it's why I should continue leading the OSBCU, and maybe why I'm not heading into provincial politics anytime soon. I think, you know, one of the things, and I spoke to Chris Wishawi about this, is we have this idea that leaders aren't humans, that for some reason, once they're elected, that they lose the other pieces. I will never stop being a mom. I will never stop being a worker. And those pieces will always come first for me. And, you know, the leadership piece is something that I see as a team. So yeah, am I disappointed in the deal? There are elements that I am still disappointed in the deal. But disappointment is actually what keeps me going. It's what gives me fodder to keep fighting. You know, knowing that we didn't achieve everything is exactly why we are already coming together to replan, to reconfigure, to see where we need to go next. And I think as far as like anything,
there's a planning phone call right there.
I know, actually. But, you know, I think it's super, super important. You know, it's also changing the face of labor. This idea that I can understand that that's the best deal on the table, but I also understand why people are going to be disappointed. And I think that my honesty, and I think the fact that I'm constantly transparent, is what actually has improved this movement, right? Is that people know that, you know, you're going to get, and I have been kind of, you know, famous for saying, you may not like the answer that I give you, but I guarantee when I give you one, that it's going to be the truth at that moment. And, you know, that's been something that I've been really, you know, I will not, you know, I will not try and pull the wool over people's eyes. I want people to know that this is what is there. And there are a lot of people who were really upset and said, well, that's not fair because you also told us all the things that could happen. Yeah, I have to tell you all of that because you're an adult and you need to go and make that decision with every single piece of information that you have. And I respect that. That's difficult, but that's what workers should have always had all the way along, is every single piece of information at their disposal.
I got a billion other questions I could ask you, but we're running short on time. And I think that's probably a good place to end it. So Laura, thank you so much for joining the QP Briefing podcast. Really appreciate it again on a Friday. And
on a Friday.
Have a great holiday season.
You too. Take care. We'll see you soon.
Ciao.